From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we learn some of the warning signs for head and neck cancers.
Many people have pain. Some people don't. If that same growth was on the tongue, maybe it would have caused pain. Swallowing problems, pain in the ear, voice changes are the other big things that we see.
Then, an artist is inspired by the unique home he lived in as a child, and after 3 years, all of the work is finally together.
To see it all together, 12 pieces in the gallery at the same time, is really exciting. The connections that I maybe knew in the back of my mind were there are suddenly right in front of me, and that's been really satisfying.
We meet one of the jurors for this year's piano arts competition and join our Good Fermentations contributor Jeanette Hurt at a cheese dinner. Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. In April 2012, Muskego resident Wayne Gerlach decided to get an odd sore in his mouth checked out at a free clinic. Well, it was a good thing he did because the sore turned out to be oral cancer. It was in the early stages, and Gerlach was successfully treated for it. But, says Dr. Becky Massey, his experience is a good example of how routine screening can lead to early intervention and better patient outcomes for a type of cancer that many of us aren't aware of. Massey is a head and neck cancer specialist at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin, and she and Gerlach joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio. Massey explained why she thinks head and neck cancers don't get as much attention as they should.
I think it's an area that is a little bit of a mystery to people and really to medical providers. It's an area that, honestly, we don't learn a lot about in medical school. And sometimes I think we think of the mouth as the dentist's realm at times, and many of the symptoms, a sore mouth, a sore tongue, may just not be things that people take seriously.
When we talk about this group of cancers, oral, head, and neck cancers, is it a single phenomenon like colon cancer or breast cancer, or is it really – are we talking about a wide range of things here?
It's really a wide range of things. We lump them all together because we as specialists treat the sites in the body that include those things. But things like tongue cancer are very different from tonsil cancer and very different from larynx cancer. But it's all the same group of risk factors and the same group of people that treat them.
How are these cancers typically detected? I mean, you mentioned that people often think of the mouth in particular as the dentist's realm. Are you getting a lot of patients who are referred by their dentists?
We do see a lot of people from dentists. Sometimes the cancers could present as a loose tooth, a painful tooth, a sore on the tongue. We see patients from dentists, from primary care doctors, and also patients that look on the internet and Google their symptoms and find us pretty directly.
Well, and that I'm sure is a double-edged sword. You must get a lot of people who Google a lot of scary things, and it turns out that they're not so scary. But this is where you come in, Wayne Gerlach. How did your mouth cancer first come to lights?
I noticed something on my cheek, or on the outside of the tooth area. I had gone to a dentist under my regular checkup. And it was early in the process, but he did see something and says, we really need to watch this. Well, in the meantime, it was progressing. I could feel it getting a little larger.
Was it painful?
No, not at all. It just had a different texture of the skin. So I said to myself, and it talks a little bit about where these things – how these things get identified. My dentist saw it, but he didn't necessarily want to treat it. And well, my internist, he wouldn't do that either. Well, I suppose I'd really have to go see a specialist, either a cancer specialist or a surgeon, but I don't know any of them. About that same time on public radio, the Larry Mueller Show, they were interviewing somebody from Froedtert perhaps, and they were going to have a head and neck cancer screening. And I went, aha, that's what I need. I followed their direction, the phone number, I believe, and made an appointment and went over and got screened. And the doctor said, I think you should see one of our specialists. And enter Dr. Massey.
Well, And Becky Massey, first of all, I'm sure half the people that are listening are now running their tongues over the insides of their cheeks. But is this a pretty typical case of how people find you?
It is. It might be something that's subtle. And Mr. Gerlach is right. It is one of those things that might get bounced around from dentist to internist and trying to find out who's the right person to take care of it. But it can be a subtle mass that things just increase in size. And as adults, we shouldn't really have things that grow in our mouth or our neck or anywhere else. Many people have pain. Some people don't. If that same growth was on the tongue, maybe it would have caused pain. Swallowing problems, pain in the ear, voice changes are the other big things that we see.
Well, so Wayne Gerlach, what was your journey from there? How did Dr. Massey and your team go about treating this?
Well, I had an initial appointment, and she also said we need to do something with this. So she asked if she could take a biopsy. First, of course, I said no. But then
– biopsy is a scary word.
Right. And she did take a piece of it. And a week or so later, maybe less, I got a call that says, you do have a squamous carcinoma. And then I responded, well, what does that mean to me? And I guess I had to come back and see her again, and we scheduled the surgery.
And this is a term that's fairly similar to a particular kind of skin cancer. Is this essentially the same kind of cancer just on the inside of the mouth versus on the external part of the skin?
Yeah, it's the same exact cancer. Those are the type of cells that both line the skin and then line the internal lining of the mouth. It's the same exact cell type. It just appears a little bit different in the mouth where our lining is pink and on our skins where it's thick and built for the external environment.
Well, and so what was the surgery like for you?
Obviously, I was, you know, not there during the surgery.
There's not much you can say about that part, but
of course, it was pretty uncomfortable for the first day, couple days. You know, all you can do is make yourself comfortable. Within maybe 4 days or so, I learned that it had not spread and that I was very fortunate I did not have to need any further treatment. And, you know, I really was thankful for that.
And you did not have to spend time in the hospital aside from
– Overnight.
Overnight, okay.
Yeah, just overnight.
Is this a case of a happy early discovery of this kind of cancer?
This is really the best scenario. Mr. Gerlach came in while he had a cancer that was easily visible to us. It's one of the great benefits of head and neck cancer. We can – with our eyes, headlights, and telescopes, we can see all the surfaces. He didn't have any lymph nodes involved. He was able to avoid radiation therapy and has really gone on to lead a really functional life. And outside of him, there are other people that affected as well. Obviously, I like when my patients do well, but the resident that was participating in the screening had the experience of knowing that the service that he was providing made a difference from someone. He identified a cancer in someone, knew that that person got to care, and I would continue to update him afterwards that Mr. Gerlach was doing well. And so I think it really reinforced to all the people who do the screening and even not the actual looking in the mouth part of the screening, but the, you know, setting up the tables, doing other things that it, you know, it really had a big impact on someone's life.
Well, and so these kinds of cancers seem to present like a classic good news, bad news scenario, that this is a very treatable cancer if it's caught early enough, but that it is not often noticed early on.
Right. Unfortunately, these cancers can send lymph nodes to the neck very early on. Once tumors are past a certain size or have risk features such as lymph nodes, we usually need to add radiation treatments and sometimes chemotherapy to the person's treatment. And while it's great that all these areas are accessible for us to see, they're, you know, unfortunately all around areas of our face and mouth that are really important to everything that we do, speaking, breathing, swallowing, looking normal. When they involve jaw bones and big surgery and radiation, it can really have a – we can cure people, but it can really have a devastating impact on their quality of life.
This must have been a fairly significant concern for you.
Absolutely.
And a fairly major dose of relief when nothing bad in that way came to pass.
Yes, that's one of those good phone calls to get.
Well, so what are the key risk factors for oral and you know this group of cancers really?
Well, for oral cancers, the main risk factors are smoking, drinking, but there's many people that have oral cancers that do not do either of those. In our country, dental irritation can also cause that. In other countries, there's a lot of other issues with sanitation and poor dentition that luckily in our country we don't have. For other cancers, there's the HPV virus that is really an epidemic of tonsil cancers in our country. And those are the main things.
Well, and do I understand, are men more susceptible to these cancers than women?
Historically, men have always had higher rates of these cancers. When, if you follow the trends in smoking and kind of look at when women started smoking a lot, you can definitely see a shadow curve of a woman catching up with men in some of these cancers.
Did you have any of these risk factors, or did this come out of the blue for you?
I guess I'd probably say I had some of those risk factors. I drink alcohol. I do an occasional cigar, much less. Dr. Mackey will be happy to be happy to hear that. Since then, but yeah, so I did. I had smoked as a young man and probably been off cigarettes for almost 40 years, but I certainly had some of those risk factors.
And obviously, as you say, this does not mean that women or men who are outside of those risk factors can't get it either. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Well, and so your cancer was diagnosed as part of first the routine screening, and then you went on to a particular kind of screening. What sort of routine screening is recommended, and at what point in life should people start to pay attention to getting screened on maybe a more routine basis?
Well, luckily, most of us see our dentist on a routine basis. There's a huge push in the entire dental field to include looking at the back of your tongue and doing a cancer screening with every six-month follow-up. And if you've been to the dentist recently, I think most people would remember the dentist pulling out their tongue and gagging them a bit. It's a real luxury, but unfortunately, not everyone has access to dental care. Our primary care providers often will look in the mouth and make sure that there's nothing obvious. But again, some of these can be very subtle things, and many young, healthy adults and even some not so young, healthy adults, we just don't see our doctors regularly unless we have a problem.
There are naturally other causes for mouth sores. Is there anything in particular that distinguishes a more benign mouth sore from something a person should get checked out? I mean, if for the people who are, in fact, running their tongues on the inside of their cheek and remembering that, what, trying to remember whether they bit themselves there. Are there things that they should, you know, how long should a sore be there before they start to get concerned?
Yes. In an adult, we generally give someone 2 weeks of having something before we tend to get worried about it. We like to see pain getting better, size staying the same or getting smaller. Anything that's increasing in size and pain and lasting longer than 2 weeks, really someone would need a biopsy or get talked into a biopsy.
Well, very good. Dr. Becky Massey and Wayne Gerlach, thank you so much for your time and best for continued health in the years to come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Becky Massey is a head and neck cancer specialist at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Wayne Gerlach is a survivor of oral cancer. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. Coming up next, an art installation and a concert based on the Ford House by Bruce Goff in Illinois. We'll talk with the artist and one of the musicians when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Can a house make you who you are? That's the central question artist Leo Burke set out to answer with his newest exhibit, The Uncertainty of Enclosure. It opened last Friday at UW-Milwaukee's Institute of Visual Arts. For much of his adolescent life, Burke lived in a mid-century house designed by progressive American architect Bruce Goff. To say it was unconventional hardly goes far enough. From the materials Goff used to the organically shaped living spaces that he created, the house is truly unique. It is one of the few Goff design homes still standing, and it's also fair to say that it made Leo Burke the artist he is. Burke, along with Sarah Krajewski, the director of Innova, joined me in the studio last week. We were joined on the phone by Rob Dillon of Third Coast Percussion. The ensemble will present a concert tomorrow night, also inspired by the Goff House. We'll hear how in just a moment. Burke began our conversation.
I started working on this body of work 3 years ago, and I have known Sarah, who lived in Seattle for a while, and she found out about the work that I was doing, and that's how this project started.
And Sarah, you are the curator at Innova.
Right. I'm the director and curator at Innova, and I began my stint at Innova in July 2012. And before moving here to Milwaukee, I had begun a conversation with Leo about this particular body of work related to the Bruce Goff home that he grew up in. And in August of that summer of 2012, Leo came out to do a research trip to the house and invited me to come down and see it with him and take a tour, walk through with the home's owner. And it was really at that moment of going to this location and understanding it as a place and as a kind of sculpture that you can live in that really pushed me to invite Leo to have the exhibition at Innova.
My understanding is that this is the first time all of your work relating to the house is in one place.
That's true. And some of the work I'm just seeing for the first time because I've been making things in residence that are just now getting completed. And I've shipped works that could not be assembled in my studio that are getting it built in the gallery today.
Is it exciting to see it?
It's really exciting. It's it's 3 years worth of work that I've seen in parts and I've seen exhibited maybe one or three pieces at a time. And to see it all together, 12 pieces in the gallery at the same time is really exciting. The connections that I maybe knew in the back of my mind were there are suddenly right in front of me. And that's been really satisfying.
Well, Rob Dillon, let's bring you in. You're joining us by phone and you're a member of Third Coast Percussion. And you are playing an interesting part in this installation, although not a permanent part.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. We're going to be performing on the evening of June 11th. And our connection to the project is very interesting that the current owner of the house, Bruce Goff House in Aurora, Illinois, is a good friend of our ensemble and one of the board members of our organization. So he sort of tied us into this in an interesting way. So we've looked at Bruce Goff's piano roll. So Bruce Goff, the architect who designed the Ruth Ford House in Aurora, where Leo grew up, was also a composer of sorts, and he composed some very unique pieces for player piano rolls, which we'll be performing on that concert.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, player piano rolls, it's so last century, early last century.
Yeah.
We don't even think of them as being something that is extant today, except as a historical artifact.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, I think so much of contemporary music relies heavily on technology that's around today, and computers have transformed the way that people perform music and consume music. Player piano is this completely different medium that was heavily technologically driven and so interesting and opened up a lot of new possibilities, but now really seems to fit in a very specific time period in our mind. And so we've been able to watch video recordings of the player piano rolls being played on the player piano. And then we've sort of made arrangements or other artistic reactions to these pieces that Goff composed for the player piano.
Now, had you seen Leo's work before this relating to the house?
No, we hadn't really. No, we're familiar with the house because we've visited a number of times, sort of on the invitation of our good friend Sidney Robinson, who's there now. And we actually have even recorded one of our albums, recorded one piece with video in this house, a piece by John Cage that calls for ordinary household objects to be employed in the performance. And so we thought it would be really amazing, rather than performing it on stage or recording it just in an ordinary living room, to actually use different parts of this amazing, amazing house. So it's interesting now, as I've been becoming familiar with Leo's work, to see those connections and to sort of see these familiar elements from the house coming through in some of the work.
Now, Leo, have you heard some of the music that's been influenced by your work?
I haven't heard these particular pieces yet, but I have been to a Third Coast concert and have, you know, listened to a lot of their performances on recordings.
Yeah, and it's pretty impressive, Rob. I have to say, you know, people think of percussion, you know, and it's not just drumming. You're talking about glockenspiels, and you're talking xylophones, and you're talking marimbas. And so there's a whole melodic thread to this in addition to the percussive thread in what you do. And I'm anxious to see how it was fun as I was doing the research for this. I was telling them as I was sitting down this morning, I was listening to you guys and I was looking at Leo's artwork at the same time, trying to get that sense of how they connect. And it's really kind of cool to witness it.
Yeah, I'm actually really fascinated by that, how this house can inspire artists of really different disciplines to produce work that, because of the source, is going to have connections that are really interesting. When I have seen just my artwork in the show, there's no way that I could not have there be interesting connections between the pieces because they're all from this one source. But then with these two different disciplines and two different artists, I feel like there's inevitably going to be interesting connections that happen.
What is it about this house that is so inspirational to both of you? And Leo, I'll start with you, and then Rob, I'll ask you to join in.
So I grew up in the house. I was 6 years old when we moved into the house, and we lived there for about 7 years. And to me, the house is more of a sculpture than a house. It functions in a way where it's like living inside of a sculpture. And of course, I didn't realize that at the time. And it's only over decades that I've really uncovered the importance of that experience. But the way it uses the space of the house, the volume, is unlike any house I've ever been in. And then the materials are incredible. The use of coal as a masonry material, nautical rope as a – not a decorative – well, a decorative material, but a wall surface, and recycled World War II pieces like Quonset hut ribs and bomber domes. And it's as if Bruce Goff rethought every single building material available to him and thought of it in more of a sculptural way than an architectural way. So the house, when we lived there, was freezing cold and leaked like a sieve. And in the summertime, it was blazing hot and very little privacy. So all of these things that you normally are taken for granted that a house would do, this house doesn't really do that well. But as an aesthetic experience, it does it perfectly for me.
Go ahead, Sarah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to comment that when we were on the tour together with Sidney Robinson, the owner of the home, he made an off-the-cuff comment about the uncertainty of enclosure as we were looking through the glass onto the property from inside the house. And that's become the title of the exhibition. And for me, that represents a way of thinking about architecture that is not about the structure, the functionality, but there's a kind of ambiguity of the use of the space. And it's thinking about it in terms of artistic expression rather than a kind of functional domicile, a container to live in. I just really love that sentiment that this architect was about, a kind of expressivity and an ambiguity that we often associate with creative expression rather than with a kind of functional structure.
And Rob, from a musical perspective, how does that all work into what you're doing?
Well, from the experiences that I've had from visiting the house, unpredictability of the materials and the every surface is a surprise, and every aspect of the home feels so different from what an ordinary house would be that it really draws your attention to the walls or the ceiling or any part of it is sort of worth your attention, things that you ordinarily take for granted in the space. And so I think the metaphorical corresponds to the type of music that our ensemble plays, and the way that we interact in this particular project is a bit more abstract. But I think the thing that's most exciting about being a percussionist and a percussion ensemble is that we have this infinite flexibility of possible materials to use in a performance. We're not tied to one instrument for each of us, you know. So the whole world can be our instrument. So it could be drums, or it could be marimbas, or it could be wooden slats or tuned metal pipes. So, and, you know, similar to how the house creates, you know, a ceiling is made of rope, rather than the things you'd normally expect a ceiling to be made out of, and a wall is made entirely of glass. In the same way, melodies in our ensemble can be made, rather than being made from a violin or a piano, or even a marimba, they can come from metal pipes, or they can come from different sized slabs of wood and things of that sort. So it's sort of an interesting tie-in for us, and something that, more than anything else, it's the house is such an interesting experience.
Sarah, what do you hope that people who don't know anything about the Goff House and might not have heard Third Coast and might not know Leo's work, what are you hoping people coming in off the street are going to experience here?
Well, I think some of the bigger questions that the exhibition asks are whether a house can shape who you are. And certainly for Leo, this idea of growing up, or the act of growing up in this home, led him to be an artist, something he didn't realize until he, you know, became an artist and started thinking about this place and its relationship to him. But the sense that our built environment and the design with which we surround ourselves does make a very strong impact on us. The sculpture in and of itself is also, on the one hand, it's a portrait of the house, the works in the exhibition, but it also becomes a kind of poetic meditation on these ideas of kind of translating materials and how over time certain sensibilities become ingrained in an artist and then become translated through the works themselves.
Well, I can't wait to, Rob, hear you guys perform. It's going to be fantastic to have you back here. And Leo, welcome to Milwaukee.
Thank you.
Sarah, thank you so much for stopping in as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Leo Burke's exhibit, The Uncertainty of Enclosure, inspired by architect Bruce Goff's Ford House in Aurora, Illinois, opened at UW-Milwaukee's Institute of Visual Arts Gallery on Milwaukee's East Side last Friday. It will remain on display through mid-August. Sarah Krajewski is the director of Innova, and Robert Dillon is a member of Third Coast Percussion. The ensemble performs Wednesday at 7:30 at Innova, giving a program that's also inspired by the Goff House. Well, another concert of a completely different sort takes place at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music tonight. We'll talk with pianist Lydia Artemu next on Lake Effect right after this short break. You're listening to us on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It is great to have your company today. Every other year, Piano Arts brings together the cream of the crop of young pianists for its North American Piano Competition. It's one of the most prominent competitions for pianists aged 16 to 20 who are living or studying in North America. The judging's been going on since Saturday, and the finalists will perform with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra on Wednesday in Eline Hall. Pianist Lydia Artemu is one of the three judges for this year's contests, but in a somewhat unusual turn, she's taking the stage herself tonight to perform a recital for the competitors and the public. I met with Artemu in a rehearsal room at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music to talk about her recital, but also about what she looks for when she judges a competition like Piano Arts.
What I'm personally looking for is a true artist. And I'm always assuming that all the young pianists who were admitted have superb techniques, because they would not have passed the pre-screening and they wouldn't be here unless they really all could play well. But for me, technique is a means to an end. It's not the end. It's not the ultimate goal. And I know that there may be some jurors who feel that everything has to be note perfect, and I don't completely agree with that. I mean, obviously, we're looking for as close to perfection as possible, but I'm looking for more than that. I want to hear playing, first of all, that has a tremendous range of color. I'd like to hear someone who has a very distinctive sound on the piano, and not just make it a piano sound, but an orchestral sound, to make different voices sound like different instruments, and to create a very singing line, which is very difficult to do on the piano, which is essentially a percussive instrument. So to make something sing and to sustain and play legato, These are very important qualities in so much music, and I'm looking for that. I'm also looking for someone who has a kind of charisma on the stage, but not in a shallow sense, not just someone who's showing off. I'm really looking ultimately for someone who loves their music so much that we can feel that love and that passion through their playing. The music becomes then really a true gift. It's a form of communication. I'm not necessarily going to agree with everything that I hear, and that for me is not the key. I know that there are many jurors who say that it should be done this way, and this is the only way. I actually don't agree with that. I think there are many different ways to interpret a piece, but it should be in the most convincing way. It's not just a question of copying what someone else did. I mean, I really want to hear someone who has their own voice, their own thoughts, their own convictions, and can bring those to life through their performance.
When students are as young as a lot of these students are, have they developed that yet? Are they old enough to have that voice yet?
I think some of them do. I really do. I think some people are born with a gift. And, of course, as you get older, hopefully that matures and you develop. But there's a certain spark that one can hear, even in a very talented 6 or 7 year old. And it's that little spark that I'm looking for. That's what I want to hear. Mostly that spark is about how much do you love what you do? Or are you just a diligent robot? That's the thing. I mean, I don't want to just hear the technical perfection. I really want to hear music making that makes me sit up. And frankly, that moves me. You know, if I move to tears or if I get chills or goosebumps, I mean, if someone plays a phrase so beautifully, and even if I've never heard it done that way before, that to me is the telling sign that this is truly an artist.
Do you hear that often in these kinds of competitions? Is that something that maybe should be more common than it is?
Well, I think it could be rare, but I think that when we hear it, we know it, and it speaks volumes. And I think the problem with competitions is that the whole nature of competitions is that you're competing against so many others, and that part of the requirement is you have to play perfectly. But sometimes playing perfectly suppresses all the emotional factors and the risk factors, because taking risks and being more individual, you know, having your own character, as I said, sometimes goes against the grain of what certain judges may feel. I've had that experience. I've been on both sides of the fence because as a youngster and in my 20s, I did a number of competitions. But the more competitions that I did when I was a student, the more determined I was to play like an artist and not like a competitor.
During the course of a competition, you're listening to a lot of competitors, and you're listening to a lot of different kind of music. How do you keep your ear fresh? How do you listen to each student as if it's the first person you've heard that day?
Well, I've thought about this many times, and I've, of course, had the experience having served on a number of juries for competitions. For me, the most important criterion and something that I hear immediately is the sound. So, number one, what I'm listening for is sound. And we're hearing all these pianists play on the same instrument. And so it's going to be very interesting to hear the ones who can produce different range of dynamics, different colors, different articulations. The second thing that really sticks out immediately is rhythm. If someone has good rhythm. Case in point, I was on the jury for another competition where a brilliant Russian girl played the Beethoven Appassionata Sonata. And she played it perfectly, except the rhythm was not good. So she didn't pass. And it didn't matter that technically it was perfect. If the rhythm is not really solid, that already compromises the performance. So sound, rhythm, and then what I said before, colors, dynamic range, contrast, and different kinds of touches on the keyboard.
Can you give me an example of that? A lot of people may not know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, let me just play a little bit of this Ukrainian piece.
Okay.
This is by Lysenko, who's one of the foremost Ukrainian composers, and I'll just play a sample of it. I mean, just from the very first note here, there's an accent written, but if I play this, it ruins the whole opening. I mean, there's an accent, but it shouldn't sound like an attack. It should sound like a note of longing, of yearning. And so, You know, sometimes the very first note can tell everything. I mean, for example, the very first chord of the Beethoven Fourth Piano Concerto is this. Now, if someone just plays, they've already ruined it. So one has to voice the chord, one has to control all the fingers, you know, so that that beat then is going to go. And it has to sing, and there has to be a sense of line, and it has to sound maybe like an oboe. You know, so how you just start, the touch, the sound, that really is everything. That tells you immediately. And again, you know, there will be other people who will disagree with that, but that's what I'm listening for, and the rhythm, and breathing. Because in music, music is made up of phrases. Phrases are sentences. And as I'm speaking now, if I were to speak like this without breathing and tell you that if you don't stop, it sounds ridiculous. Well, of course it sounds ridiculous. It's exactly the same as speaking. Every phrase is a sentence. And it goes to a certain high point, and then it comes down, and then you have a comma or a period. And I want to hear that in the performance. I really want to hear breathing. Many pianists don't breathe. And I can really feel that. See, if you work with a singer or with a wind player, you have to breathe, because they have to breathe, and you've got to go with them. So these are all important components, and all of them have to be there. And they all have to be there at the same time. They can't just be scattered about. And finally, the goal is to make it all seem effortless.
That yes. You're breathing easily.
Right.
Yeah.
And that you know exactly where the phrase goes. You have control over all the voices and the colors and the dynamics. It all should sound just very natural. And of course, it takes years to develop that, but, you know, for truly gifted young artists, I think they already have a sense of that.
You talked about the problems of competitions like this, but what do competitions like this provide young musicians on the positive side?
Oh, there are many positives. I mean, first of all, they're going to be heard by a number of people. I mean, just in the working process, this is very important, because if you really take a competition seriously and do all the work that's required, you are meeting certain goals. And so for a young person, that's important, to have the discipline and to put in all the hours of practice that are required, to learn a lot of new repertoire, and to have it ready at performance level. This is the most important goal when you're preparing to be a performer. You have to do that. You have to learn how to do that. And learning new pieces is very important, and then really bringing them up to a very high level quickly. In this competition, there are other factors, because they not only play solo recitals, but they'll play a concerto, and they do some chamber music, and some contemporary music as well, I believe. So we're hearing like a whole package. Part of being a successful performer these days is also being versatile. You can't just play one kind of music. You really have to show that you can play different styles, different periods, and you have to be able to learn quickly. So all of this is important in the preparation for the competition. Then I think, you know, once the young artists are here and they're performing, those performances, under the best of circumstances, when they feel inspired, I mean, those sometimes can be performances that they will remember for the rest of their lives. And there are going to be all new people hearing them play. And from the point of view of career, which is also important, networking, you know, meeting other successful musicians, talking to the jury, this is also important, having an interaction with the jury. Many of the competitions in the past, the contestants never had anything to do with the jury. And the jury, you know, those were the formidable, really frightening, terrifying people who were sitting there with their pencils and writing. And, you know, you never really knew what they felt or what they thought, and there were very few opportunities to find that out. But here it's different, so it makes it much more human and humane, both.
And one of the other things, and we'll end with this, one of the other things that you get to do as a juror here is that you get to perform, and the students here competing get to hear you mm-hmm. in a performance setting.
That's right. Well, that's actually unusual, because many times during competitions, it's so hard when we're listening to so many performers. And going from early in the morning till late at night, it's very hard to even think about playing your own program. But I did want to do this here because I think it's one thing just to sit and criticize, and it's another thing for one of the judges to go on the stage and do what the students have to do, take that risk. And it's a great challenge. I mean, it's scary for me too, because I know that I have to really try to deliver my best performance to show the students, you know, really how I feel. I mean, I can tell them, well, you need to do this and this and this, but then if I'm not doing it, then I'm a hypocrite. But it's not easy to do that. So it'll be certainly an extra challenge, but I look forward to it.
So you're going to play a little bit for us of one of the pieces that you're going to perform during your recital. What is it?
Well, I'm including a group of Ukrainian solo pieces because no one knows them, and I thought it would be interesting to play something that is very rarely performed. My parents were Ukrainian, and I speak Ukrainian, even though I was born in Philadelphia. And this piece that I'm going to play is called an elegy, and it's really by the most famous of all the Ukrainian composers, named Mykola Lysenko. And so Lysenko was born 1842, lived till 1912, and he really was like the grandfather, the most famous of all the Ukrainian composers. And there is a quality in this music that is always present, which is this quality of yearning. And you can hear that quality in this music, which is one of the reasons I enjoy playing it. And I think it's really wonderful music. It reminds me a little bit of Scriabin, except Scriabin was later. So, you know, as I said, it's just interesting to hear something that to play something no one knows. It's also very hard to get the music these days. A lot of this music is out of print. So I thought it would just be something new.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing it, but first I want to say, Lydia, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. I know it's been a long day.
Oh, it's a pleasure, really.
Lydia Artemyu performing an elegy by Ukrainian composer Mykola Lysenko. Artemyu is one of three judges at this year's Piano Arts Competition. In addition to her own professional career, she's the Distinguished McKnight Professor of Piano at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Artemyu, along with Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra principal cellist Susan Babini and Chicago Lyric Opera concertmaster and former MSO violinist Robert Hanford, will perform a recital tonight at 7:30 at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. We'll take one last break and then head to a cheese dinner. Yes, you heard that right. We'll give you a chance to get a napkin before we return with more of Lake Effect. You're listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin is the land of cheese, and so naturally, we cheeseheads will often socialize with a plate of cheesy goodness by our sides. But have you ever gone to a social gathering that was solely about artisan cheese, such as a cheese dinner? Well, Lake Effect's cheese guru Jeanette Hurt says a cheese dinner is just what it sounds like, a dinner focused on cheese. Lots and lots of locally sourced artisan cheese. Hurt attended a cheese dinner last year at La Merenda restaurant in Walker's Point, and she shares her insights.
At a cheese dinner, the cheese stands center, but it doesn't stand alone. It's not one of those stuff all the cubes of cheese into your mouth with only a few bites of crackers in between kinds of things. When you do get samples, it's not a cheese out. Instead, the cheeses get incorporated into decadent, melt-in-your-mouth masterpieces in unexpected and delightful ways.
We're going to start off with a little taste of all the cheeses before each course, so you can just try the cheese as is. Consider it like an amuse-bouche of cheese. Then you're going to see it how we feel is a fun way to present it in a food format.
Take, for example, La Merenda chef Pete Sandroni's expertly designed first course, a spinach salad made with a cheesy vinaigrette, paired with a Purple Feet wine guy Nate Norfolk's Italian Fiulano. The first cheese, Marika Zacte Borenkas, is an American original, meaning there are no European counterparts. It was described as a Gouda that became a Brie, but without the rindy white stuff. As an oozy, meltable cheese, I thought it would probably make a mean grilled cheese sandwich. But in this case, Chef Pete didn't just add the cheese to the salad. He blended the cheese right into the vinaigrette so that it was almost creamy. It was delightful. But like I said, cheese dinners aren't just about the cheese. We also got a taste of Epicurean history as we started digging into our spinach mounds, courtesy of this cheese's namesake maker, Marika Penterman of Holland's Family Farm, based in Thorpe, Wisconsin.
I'm from Holland, from Netherlands, as a cheese head. In Holland, we are called cheese heads, by the way, too. And a little story behind the cheese head, goudas are made in malts, round malts. In the early days in Holland, they were made from wood. And when we would go to war, we would take that wooden mold and we would put it on our head. And that's the reason why we are called cheese heads.
Now, when I first met Penterman, her cheese was already turning heads in dairy circles as her fenugreek Gouda took first place in its category at the U.S. Cheese Championship. 2 years ago, she topped all of her bests, taking first place at that same championship with her aged Gouda. Every time I taste Penterman's ethereal Gouda, I remember watching some bewildered new dairy cows first arriving to her family farm. It's that fresh.
First off, I have to correct myself. Yes, I'm admitting I made a mistake, Dad.
That was followed by another featured cheesemaker, Katie Hedrich of LeClaire Farms in Malone, Wisconsin. A newlywed and only in her 20s, this cheerful wunderkind, Hedrich, is already a cheese force to be reckoned with, and she shows no signs of slowing down.
So many things have been happening that it's kind of amazing. So 2011, about a year and a half after we started making, we won the U.S. Cheese Championship, which was something that we never thought would happen. And then we actually bought another 200 goats to continue to producing the milk. And we actually have the opportunity this year that we will be opening our on-farm retail store. We'll be milking the goats, making the cheese, and then have our on-farm retail store.
I knew that I'd love whatever Chef Pete did with Hedrick's Evalon, a nutty, aged goat cheese. But what I didn't know is how good her Chandoka would be, or where the name came from.
Chandoka is actually the name of my grandparents' farm, which is where we are building our new creamery. So Chandoka stands for Charmaine and Donna and Kathy, which is my grandma and her three sisters. And that cheese actually is a brand new cheese that I've been working on.
The Chandoka cheese bisque was creamy and wonderful, but what stands out from that second course is not the soup, but the rocket baby Chandoka cheese bread that accompanied it.
So tonight's bread that's served with the soup course has also got the same cheese baked right into it.
A buttery, springy, brioche-like creation. This is the bread dreams are made of. And I still, months later, dream of it.
So the Evalon that you guys will be tasting...
Hedrick's Evalon, not an afterthought, starred in a pork loin rouladen with spätzle and a Pinot Noir sauce.
Evalon is actually our signature cheese, and when we were creating this cheese, we wanted something that was really unique. So the Evalon actually is patterned after a Gouda style with a little hint of an Italian finish to it. And so as it ages out, it starts out with some of those Asiago flavors, so the fruitiness to it. And then as it ages out, it becomes more like a Parmesan.
That was followed by Penterman's award-winning aged Gouda with a Palme Dauphine and lamb loin. Needless to say, I was sighing with pleasure as I tasted, and so were the other guests at my dinner table.
Fantastic. I thought I would get tired of cheese by the second or third course, but there's a lot of versatility.
Well, we're used to selling cheese just pairing it with wine or beer. what Peter did is he actually baked it into something, made it more creative, which we're not used to. We're not that creative. But he did a great job with the soups, with the meats. I mean, it's just a great combination, which is absolutely
from
amazing.
From salad to dessert.
Yeah, especially that salad.
Also sitting at my table was Jen Eady, editor of the new Edible Milwaukee magazine. We had fun riffing on the cheeses, the paired wines, and the courses.
Wow, it's kind of hard to choose what I'm enjoying most. I think on the one hand, there are so many great stories behind the cheese that we're eating. And just the other thing is just eating them. I mean, I'm a Wisconsinite at heart, and when you do a dinner that's exclusively focused on cheese, you know, you're hitting the right mark, so it's very delicious.
Of course, no good cheese dinner ends without dessert. That's how I got to meet Ron Henningfeld, the cheesemaker at Clock Shadow Creamery, one of the only urban cheese plants in the country. Clock Shadow is known for its sweet curds and fresh cheeses, and perhaps the most interesting of those cheeses is Quark. Quark is sort of like a cross between ricotta and creme fraiche. It's a spreadable, creamy cheese with a little bit of a tart kick, like a cream cheese for grown-ups.
Quark is a European-style cheese, most popular in Central Europe. Quark is the German name on the cheese. It's a fresh cheese, so the sooner you eat the cheese, the better it is. It's a versatile cheese, good for the cooking, the baking, but also good just to eat it plain on crackers or toasted bagel or roll it up in crepes and that sort of thing.
And Chef Pete made a cocoa-dusted cheese souffle, topping it with just a dab of balsamic-laced strawberries. It was light and fluffy and sweet, and I may have just gotten my hands on one extra. At the risk of sounding cheesy, this tart quark souffle made for a sweet and heavenly end to the evening. For Lake Effect, I'm Jeanette Hurt.
Lake Effect's Good Fermentations cheese contributor Jeanette Hurt is the author of 8 books, including The Complete Idiot's Guide to Gluten-Free Eating, The Cheese of Wisconsin, A Culinary Travel Guide, and The Complete Idiot's Guide to Wine and Food Pairing. Hurt went to a cheese dinner designed by La Merenda's chef Pete Sandroni, featuring local Wisconsin cheeses made by Marika Penterman of Holland's Family Farm, Katie Hedrick of LeClaire Farms, and Ron Henningfeld of Milwaukee's Clock Shadow Creamery. Hurt will be speaking at the Blue Ribbon Cheese Fest at the Elegant Farmer in Mequonago starting at noon on June 29th. Well, now I want cheese, so I'm off to find some. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.